On this episode of Movies Ruined My Life, it's a disavowed Tom Cruise running, jumping, and hanging from things. Plus explosions. It's the Mission Impossible franchise. All right, so this is Danny.
Hello, audience.
That's Devin off screen.
Hello.
And Mission Impossible. Now, this is a film series that's been, well, I guess now, in its 20-year anniversary, right? 2016, first film. My favorite of the series with Brian De Palma back in 96. I actually saw that at the drive-in. It was a two-for-one night. I saw that and The Phantom, which is pretty solid.
The Phantom, eh? Yeah. Which one did you see first?
Mission Impossible was like the marquee picture, and then The Phantom was the if you want to stay around. And
it's a decent double bill, actually.
Yeah, no, I really like that film, actually. Okay, so I just want to start off. How would you guys rank these films? Purely for enjoyment. I don't care about special effects or story or any of that shit. Just give me your favorite from 5 through to 1. Which do you like worst? Which do you like the best? And maybe a quick why, whatever you feel inclined to do so. Danny, you mind kicking us off?
Sure. Okay. Coming in first would be Mission Impossible 3 with Philip Seymour Hoffman, because...
And you like that one the best?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so we'll go from top then. We'll go from the top.
Yeah, we'll go from 1th to 5th.
Okay, 1th.
So 1th would be MI3 because of Hoffman. He's so great. The Tooth, coming in second would be the original, just a tad inferior to MI3, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I don't make many comments on that one. Third, MI5, Rogue Nation.
Rouge Nation?
Just because the villain was so fantastic. It's, you just told me a couple days ago that was Ian Curtis from 24 Hour Party People.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's very nice to see he's got his life together after that unpleasant suicide. But he was just everything a villain should be. He was cold, he was frightening, and even when he got captured, he didn't beg. He just stared at them angrily because he's a villain and he doesn't give a shit.
Yep.
It was awesome. Coming in 4 would be Mission Impossible 4, the Ghost Protocol one, where they all get disavowed because the U.S. government are...
Well, they all get disavowed in every film.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Mission Impossible movies are not as patriotic as movies of this kind usually are.
Yeah.
The government are always weasels. They're always bureaucratic cowards.
Yeah.
And coming in dead last would be the John Woo one, the Mission Impossible 2. Like I said, I remember more the promotional cycle for that one than the film itself.
Right on. So you have, because I already forgot what the fuck you just read off. So 3 is at number 1. Then you have 1. And then you have MI5, Rogue Nation,
yep,
at 3? Okay. And then 4. And okay.
4 and 2.
Okay. Yeah. Devin?
I mean, I apologize, but I haven't seen 4. I mean, I've read through the synopsis here. I think it looks like a great movie.
But you didn't even know that you hadn't seen 4 until we showed up. That's what's hilarious. Is they're all so fucking close?
They're pretty similar. I mean, I would have to put, so we're going from top to bottom. Mm. I mean, like I said,
number 4 is at 1.
Number 1 is number 1.
All right.
Number 3 is number. Doing it this way is going to be...
number 3 is number 2, and number 5 is number 2.
Okay, so the first movie is my favorite. I think it really captured a lot of what I like about it, like people with their individual jobs to do, things not being very clear, not overly... gadgety, and like, you know, save for the face morphers, I mean, pretty much everything was
in that film, not, it was a little more simplistic. They had to find someone who looked like the person they were trying to impersonate.
Yeah, and so to that end, it's not so much like, how are we going to get into this place? Oh, I have a perfect, you know, device that will allow for this, or you know,
we'll change my height.
Yeah, and so, so yeah, so number one is I think my favorite. Mm-hmm. Number three comes in second place for sure. Mission Impossible 3. Hoffman's great bad guy.
Amazing.
Tom Cruise is a great crazy guy. Number three on my list would be Mission Impossible 5. It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really fun. And I do like spy agency versus spy agency.
Yeah, I like them bringing that back from the TV show, yeah.
I would like if there was more of like a crew aspect, kind of like the Mission Impossible team has.
Yeah.
Where if there were people who were not that great at just like fighting on the other guy's team, and
yeah,
it's like they find their hacker and he sucks yeah. too. Like he also can't.
Oh, you're the computer guy. I'm the computer guy.
Like when Milhouse meets Shelbyville Milhouse.
So this is what it's like when doves cry.
Then number four for me. I'm just going to say number four because I really I could only assume that number two would still be at the bottom of my list if I had seen number four. That being said, I mean, I think they're all fun. I mean, I think there's still things to enjoy even about number two.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But it's a pretty big approval cliff that it falls off for me at that point.
Okay, so for me, Mission Impossible 1996 is at the top. Brian De Palma being at the helm, I feel, gives it a really unique feel. The fact that it is a very technical film, and some of his criticism was the fact that the plot was fairly, or people felt the plot was convoluted, but the thing is that multi-layered story, you kind of want that feel from a spy movie. You kind of want the feel that everyone is playing someone else in the film. And so I very much enjoy that. I like that Ethan Hunt's character's not just good at everything yet. I like that he's, you know, for example, the train sequence at the end, he has to just climb up and I guess I have to chase after him. I guess I have to chase after Jim, whatever. And Gene Reno is great. Just fantastic film. In second place, I have MI3. Same reasons as you guys. Basically, Philip Seymour Hoffman is the man. And I miss him a great deal. I think that you have the most to connect with the Ethan Hunt character in that film, more so than any of the other films. He's actually a human being, not just the idea of a hero. He's obviously engaged, and he's training new operatives and so forth, and he wants to remove himself from the battle, and I think that's very interesting. Then I have number four next. In third place, Ghost Protocol, which is higher than both you guys. Of course, Devin, you don't really count because you haven't seen it, apparently. But I love this film right from the opening sequence where he's in the Russian prison, and you don't know why he's in the Russian prison. He's just in the Russian prison, and Simon Pegg's character is trying to be like, okay, come on, like go this way, and. Tom's looking up at the camera, Ethan's looking up at the camera and telling him to open other doors, and he wants to go the other way, and just what he does with the other Russian prisoner, Bogdan, is it? Mm. And he's using him like a human shield, but he's throwing him around and trying to get him out of there. That's all really interesting, and of course that character comes back to play a little bit of a role later on in the film, which is nice. It all flows really well. It's good in that regard. I think it flows a lot better than some of the other films. In all seriousness, in terms of pacing, this one is one of the best in the series, besides number one, which is untouchable for me. In fourth, I have MI5. again, similar reasons to you guys. Love the villain. Love the idea of the syndicate. Where it falls off for me is the third act. I can't get over the fact that I feel like that the writers had half a script written and they were like, wow, this is really good. Mm. High five. What do we do now? And they didn't know. So they just kind of meandered about with a plot until they could type, you know, fade out.
Yeah, well, they relied on the classic trope of putting the one of the characters in mortal danger. Simon Pegg gets kidnapped, and he gets a bomb strapped to his chest, I think.
Yeah.
Bomb and a camera.
What the fuck is his name again?
Oddly enough. Who, Simon Pegg?
Yeah.
I don't know. Oh, Benji.
Benji, yeah. So Benji's in danger.
I think they named him that deliberately. They wanted him to be like a dog.
A loyal dog.
A loyal dog.
Yeah. I am... It's just the whole thing with... Okay, so in three, Tom Cruise can read lips in three. No, Ethan can read lips in three. In four, he doesn't need to read lips anymore. And then in five, he can apparently memorize shit. And that's his new superpower, is he has a wicked memory.
When does this happen? Because
he's like... That's why he goes to meet... them at the restaurant, and he's like, if you want this information, it's here. You can't kill me because it's in my brain.
Right, yes.
And that just seems like such fucking bullshit to me. Because you get, like, you know, I deleted it, but it's in my head.
Right.
And you're completely reliant on the fact that this guy just has a good memory. Like, if he fucks up one digit, you know, he's completely worthless.
It's an entire file, isn't it?
Yeah.
He memorized.
And this is why I can't put it higher on my list. As much as aesthetically it's fantastic, like you said, the villain, all of the villains, like even the henchmen, that great scene where Ethan is tied up and they're just wailing on him, and he has to escape and, of course, gets help from the one operative that's kind of playing both sides.
Yep.
I love all of that, but I can't come to terms with the fact that it just seems like as soon as you hit the third act, the film doesn't make any sense anymore. It's like the first two acts were written by a very coherent mind. And then the third one, they went out for too many beers one night and came back and were like, oh, fuck, I got to finish the script by tomorrow. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, the quality does dip off noticeably, but for me, at that point, I've been so carried along by the momentum, I was just like, whatever.
Yeah, also the falling off the motorcycle thing. Like, I know people who've fallen off a motorcycle while it's stopped and been injured more than Tom gets injured falling off of it while it's just flying at, like, 200 miles an hour. And then MI2 is at the bottom of my list, obviously, as much as I love flaming door frames and doves and underground tunnels and these sorts of things, you know, all the marquees of a great John Woo film. I just can't get over the fact that it felt like, even at the time, very much a cut and paste job, you know. But in any case, I wanted to bring up to how close Tom Cruise has been with this franchise since its conception. Obviously, Skydance is one of the production houses that it's involved in the film. He's a producer on every single one of them.
Yep.
And it's so interesting that even though he has his fingerprint on the film and he's very demanding and so forth, he's very much able to almost treat the series a little bit like a comic book. And I think that's appropriate, seeing as we just finished up comic book month, to mention the fact that this series, they are very much all standalone pieces. As much as they're supposed to be chronologically sequential, per se, it's somewhat irrelevant because they all just kind of, much in the way of a comic book, they could very well be an alternate universe or just a hypothetical and things like that. If you compare it to, say, for example, the X-Men or any Marvel character, and we're going to talk in a minute, or actually let's just do it now, the connection between X-Men and Mission Impossible 2, Because if you guys remember, I said in the X-Men episode that there was another actor originally cast as Wolverine before Hugh Jackman, and that is Doug Gray Scott, who's the villain. He plays Sean Ambrose in 2.
Right.
He plays the only guy that can disguise himself as Ethan Hunt. But yeah, so it's a really interesting franchise because it seems to be very fluid. Like it can just go, it can be whoever's manning the helm of it wants it to be. It seems very pliable, which is interesting. And I like that. I like that. Because again, it just reiterates the fact that it is just a fun series of movies. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be interesting visually. It's supposed to be compelling because of its action pieces and these sorts of things. It's not anything to be studied, you know, as one of the greatest pieces of film to come out of, you know, a given decade or something like that. But it's a standalone piece because it's just candy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's escapism, pure entertainment. It's not ever supposed to be political commentary where these bad guys who do want to take over the world have some kind of, you know, motive that can be seen as an allegory for our current political climate. It's never been like that. Not like the great action movies of the 80s where it was usually a Russian villain, you know?
Yeah.
I forget which Rocky was the Russian one. I think
4.
4, yeah. Or like the Rambo films or something.
Yeah.
It's such a... But...
And even you brought up Bond, like the whole... I guess it's Living Daylights where he's in Afghanistan for a bit of that film and these sorts of things. Yeah, they absolutely kind of parody. A lot of these spy films or action films, they tend to kind of borrow a little bit from the social climate, absolutely. And this film series is like, fuck it, whatever. Tie Tom to a plane and shoot it.
Great, yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, and I mean, it's weird because like you guys were saying that in these movies, people are just categories. They are their vocations. It's weird because with Tom Cruise, like, I don't even know what is going on in that guy's head. He just seems so intensely focused all the time. And it seems like with Mission Impossible, he has something to prove, and that would be that he's capable of the kind of, you know, the demanding physicality that it takes to do all the stunts that he does do. What does he do, 80% of his stunts?
Majority. Even when they have another stunt guy on set, they generally always, they'll do as many shots as they can with him. Now, I remember the story. The second film stands out for me because they actually never got permission, and they never got they never cleared it through insurance to actually do all the climbing shit in Utah.
Oh,
from the
really?
Beginning of the film.
Wow.
Because no one would ever allow Tom Cruise, whether he was on wires or not, to just like hang off the side of a cliff with one hand and shit like that.
Oh, wow.
So they just went and did it and then told them after the fact.
Oh my God. Well, you have to admire that, I guess. It's just like, is it brave or is it psychotic? Like,
yeah. And the same thing with one, when they were doing the train stuff, which is supposed to be in France, but they shoot it. Where did they shoot it? They shot it in Scotland, I think. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't. And then obviously, like the close-up stuff, and when he climbs out on the train and all that. Most of it's shot in a studio, and I believe actually the same studio that a lot of the Bond stuff is shot in. Don't quote me on that, but I'm almost positive. And so, like the exterior stuff is on site, but all the or some of it, but most of it is. On a soundstage, and they couldn't replicate the wind velocity that they wanted. Like Tom was adamant that he wanted, when he climbed up on the roof of the train, that he wanted it to like the wind just like fuck up his face and shit. Like he wanted to be so vicious, and so they spent a ton of time trying to find a wind machine that was powerful enough, and the only thing that they could find was a wind machine that they used for skydiving, which again Tom knew about because of his skydiving lessons.
Right.
And so they found one in all of Europe and had the thing brought in to the soundstage so that they could, you know, get those shots with just him, his tie just ripping off of him and all of this stuff. And you got to wonder, like, how fucking crazy are you, dude? like you want to make your life just absolutely miserable.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what's great about all the stunt scenes all throughout the series is when he has that intense look of concentration on his face, you know he's not acting because he's actually trying not to die.
Yeah.
So that's what's good about it. But the whole, because everyone's a category, it does miss a lot of opportunities for humor that it could mine, but...
Yeah.
The action sequences are kind of the focus, not so much the jokes. I don't know.
I like the way that that like Mission Impossible 2 cliff climbing scene, like the insurance issues, like what that says about like Hollywood insurance in general. Like,
yeah.
wait, you're going to put Tom Cruise up on a mountain? No way. Like, okay, yeah. you're going to put some guy who might die? Okay, that's
I
fine.
Don't think they could have done it even with just some guy.
There's literally like a dollar value put on human life.
Yeah.
And if it's Tom Cruise, then that is too much money. But
yeah.
if it's some other guy, okay, he can die. We don't care.
Yeah, and they always have problems with it. They never just are eventually just give in. Because it's like even with Jack Reacher and some of the stuff that he's done more recently, the Night and Day with Cameron Diaz and stuff, a lot of these sequences, they had to kind of lie about how they were shooting them. Like, oh, wait, you're going to get Tom behind a muscle car, but you're going to get a stunt guy to do some of the driving, et cetera, just to get it. Just to get insurance. And with the Mission Impossible series, like, he's had at least like a half dozen reasonably major injuries, like shoulder injuries, and like I think he might have had to have something done to his lower back and leg injuries and stuff. He's not quite as crazy in terms of like having to get as many surgeries as someone like Jackie Chan or something like that, but it's super physical, you know, and demanding. And
I don't even
applaud him. You got to applaud him for it.
I don't even know what kind of medical treatment he's getting because of his religious beliefs. Doesn't he not go to hospitals?
He does, but he can't use like painkillers and stuff like that.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. So that brought that conversation to a halt. In any case, do you gentlemen want to get into the films?
Sure.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to break it down. We're going to do, I guess, three segments. We'll talk a little bit. We'll go 1 and 2, 3 and 4, and then we'll bring it home with 5 and maybe either our hopes for 6 or what have you. So Mission Impossible, 1996. Obviously directed by Brian De Palma. Now, I think I've mentioned in past episodes, this is the first film that I ever saw of Brian De Palma's, which I know seems insane, but keep in mind I was 10 when this film came out.
Right.
And I saw it driving with the Phantom.
Yeah.
As I already mentioned. Great day. I love this film. I love how this film looks. And I think a lot of trends from this film have gone on and appeared in other action pieces. Obviously, I mentioned the Wolverine Mission Impossible train kind of thing in the X-Men episode. That scene in the restaurant where it's just the shots between Kittredge and Ethan are just going back and forth and back and forth, and it's below them, it's angled up. That intensity and the camera work in that scene really drives that. I not that it wasn't there in the performances. I think that in particular that scene is incredibly well acted in this film. But I love that how that's shot. And I don't think even the other directors who have done Mission Impossible films would shoot a scene like that in a similar way. You know, which is apparent in the fact that obviously, for example, Mission Impossible 1 stands out because Ethan never fires a gun in the fucking movie. And there's not a huge shootout sequence or anything like that. It's a very, very action-based film, and yet there's no gunfire. And it's really interesting I think that takes a special kind of director, and having De Palma kind of, I guess, coming towards the tail end of his the best part of his catalog, in my opinion, is I wouldn't have wanted to see this film in anyone else's hands.
I mean, again, it's a real toss-up for me between one and three. I mean, number one, I think obviously there's that iconic CIA infiltration scene.
Yeah, the Langley, amazing.
It's just really masterfully done.
And Gene Reno in the vent with the rat. So good.
There's so many, you're worried about one thing, and then, you know, he gets past that, and it's like all of a sudden, because there's all of these different sensors, so it's like, okay, like, no worries, he stopped right before he hit the floor, so we're fine. Oh, wait, like, the temperature's going up by, like, 0.1 degrees, shit. Like, oh, wait, there's a tiny bead of sweat on his nose. Like, any of these things could completely fuck the whole operation.
Yeah.
And it's just great that there's that, you know, such a tight threshold. I Krieger helps them break in there. Gene Reno.
Yeah.
And he's not, he's the double agent. I don't.
Yeah. He's already been, the thing is Claire picks him.
Why didn't he just drop him? You know, why didn't he?
Because he needs the knock list. He knows that Ethan is the only one that can get it. So that's the thing. You don't know at that point, but Jim is playing Ethan because Ethan has communicated to Max that she'll get the list. So Max is saying to the real Job, this is the situation. He's saying, okay, we'll let this guy do it because he's the only one that can do it.
You know? And also, if he were to drop him, that'd be a pretty elaborate way to kill him.
Yeah.
He could have done something else if it were his intention.
Yeah, you just stabbed the shit out of Sarah at the beginning.
What's your plan, Krieger? You going to just shoot him? No. I got this figured out. We're going to break into the CIA, right? Yeah. Are you still with me? No, we're not.
I'll plan the most elaborate mission known to man, and then just as he's about to succeed, I'll drop him.
Yeah.
That strikes me as a very Gene Reno plan, though.
Yeah. I love Gene Reno, man. He's the best.
And I did want to mention, too, while there's no guns, there certainly is a lot of explosive gum, isn't there?
Yeah, a lot of explosive gum.
Krieger gets killed by the chewing gum.
Central.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, to jump onto your point, Devin, is the fact that he, again, with the elaborate, like, for real this time, with an elaborate measure of killing Ethan, instead of just picking up John Voight and leaving Ethan on the outside of a fucking train, he tries to kill him with the helicopter blades. He's trying to angle him down, and Ethan just jumps on, does the red light, green light, and smacks it on the window and jumps off.
Right, but that does work pretty effectively. I remember a John Woo film where there's a train fight and helicopter blades are used to great effect to knock a bunch of people off
fantastic.
The front of the train.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying it just jumped,
Yeah, it's a little weird to use a helicopter
down with elaborate
as a weapon.
Yeah.
Death by helicopter, death by chewing gum.
Yeah. This series has it all. Any kind of inanimate object you can use to kill someone, they're going to do it. I very much like the interaction. If you remember from the opening sequence, okay, there's a shot of Ethan and Claire kissing. That's not in the film. The spark lights and they're following the trail, and then in between it's cutting sequences from the movie and there's a scene there. And I love that they actually cut that out of the film, that it's just, because it makes Ethan's longing for Claire, which in all seriousness, who isn't in love with Emmanuel Barrett? In all seriousness, mm-hmm. She's beautiful. But I love that because it just makes that longing all the more tense. You know, I think that if you ever saw that kind of come to fruition, then you'd be... It's alluded to, obviously. You assume that they do it. But it's not seen. It's just alluded to, and it makes it so much more compelling somehow. I don't know. I love that. I love that he's blind. He's completely blind to Claire's manipulation. And that's so interesting. Even when he's replaying the events of the night and is trying to figure out, say, for example, who blew up Hannah and all of these things. And you get, in his mind, you get him thinking, okay, Claire blew up Hannah. And then, no, wait. No, he could have done that. Jim could have done it. And just is completely unwilling to accept the fact that it's pretty obvious Claire's in on this. And even when Gene Reno thinks he has the disc and they have to do a little magic trick to get the disc back from him, trick him into thinking that Ethan still has the disc. All of that, if he wasn't blinded by this just insane desire for this woman, he would have just been like, yep, get out. Or shoot her, or whatever. Then you would have got a shot, a gunshot in the film, at least. You know,
the soul gunshot, would be for his.
Jim shoots her in the end anyway, so I guess it. There's one gunshot, but there's no gunfight, which all of the other films have. Anything else you gentlemen want to touch on with this film? I think that there's so much more we could talk about. Obviously, you get that great Luther Stickle character. Showing up for the first time. And there's a little bit of the, a little bit better quips than you see from Tom and Ving Rhames. Get a little bit more, oh, hi there, and all of these things from him when they're breaking into Langley.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just noticed that a trend that really started ramping up in the 90s was at the end of a film, something would be said. You know, they might as well be saying, well, pretty soon we'll be making a sequel, so get ready for that. Because, I'm pretty sure he tries to quit.
And they put it on a plane. He gets on the plane, and your missions, should you choose to accept.
Yeah.
Or no, they don't get to that part. It's just like, could I interest you in, the film of whatever nation it is? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, then again, I mean, who started this trend? I would like to know who started this trend.
Yeah.
Maybe Bond? No. They're kind of standalone films.
Yeah.
The Die Hard certainly didn't do it.
No.
The Die Hard's always have a John McClane and a blanket for some reason. The cops are like, here, you're tired. Have this blanket. It's like, it's warm out. Have the blanket.
Just take the fucking blanket.
Holly! John!
You know, when I was reading about this film, something else that I noticed, it's the last major studio release of any major film studio to come out on Betamax.
Really?
Yeah. I was surprised to read that. 1996, still releasing Betamax.
That's really late.
It's coming back.
What?
No, okay. It's obviously not. But
oh, man, that would be terrible. Would you guys like to move on to 2?
Yeah, let's move on to 2, the John Woo one.
We'll bounce around. I'm sure some of the stuff from 1 is going to come back up. So 4 years after Mission Impossible 1, we're thinking that there's going to be an immediate another case that Ethan's on. Nope. Instead, it takes 4 years, ample time for him to grow his hair out and acquire a predilection for Metallica, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I love how you were writing down Metallica as I said Metallica.
Yeah. Well, that's what I don't remember a whole lot of this movie, but what I do remember was the promotional sequences and cycles. Like, it was everywhere. It wasn't just the Limp Bizkit song or the Metallica song, which they played at the MTV Movie Awards, I remember, Metallica. Yeah. They were introduced by Ryan Felipe.
Yeah.
Which was really weird.
First movie that they ever contributed an original song for, or rather that they wrote specifically for that film.
Yeah.
Metallica, which is interesting.
Yeah, because they gave their music to the Paradise Lost guys, but they didn't write for the... Well, like, I remember also on TV before MI2 came out, there was an hour-long special, like, kind of a life of a paparazzi guy. Paparazzi, is that plural? Paparazzo?
Yeah.
Whatever. A guy who takes pictures of celebrities and sells them for a living. and he had staked himself out in the Utah desert with camouflage to get photos of Tom Cruise. And he hadn't sold them, but he claimed to have pictures of Tom Cruise urinating because, I mean, you know, it's a movie
People
set.
Have to pee, yeah.
But, like, I remember that was just an hour-long special, and that was pretty cool, too. And this is all before the movie came out.
Interesting.
Anyway.
So, yeah, that opening sequence is really cool. And then for some reason you end up him in some city having cappuccino with Anthony Hopkins. So he finally got the cappuccino that he requested, number one. So that's pretty good. And obviously, this film is completely stylistically different. You go from De Palma to Wu, and obviously throughout the series, up until the newest one, which I guess will be the first film that's directed, you know, two in a row by the same director. But every film up till this point has been a different director at the helm. So there are some signature, you know, John Woo elements to the film, obviously. The motorcycle stuff. The fucking doves. He loves his doves.
He does. He has usually more wooden dialogue, at least more so than De Palma.
Yeah. He doesn't really care.
No, John Woo does not.
Just say the words, let's get to shit blowing up.
Yeah, he would probably like to direct a silent action film someday.
Oh, that would be... I would watch that.
Yeah, me too.
In all seriousness, as much as this film, for me, is my least favorite... there's some really interesting stuff in it, like I alluded to already, the motorcycle fight at the end, and the that shot that just cuts to the knife like an inch from Tom Cruise's eye.
Ooh,
which yeah, which they did, like Tom insisted on them actually putting it like putting a cable, tying a cable, and forcing it, having Doug Ray Scott actually like force it down and push as hard as he can and have it just like that. It can't go any farther than like a quarter of an inch away from his eye. And so they're actually legitimately fighting for that shot. And that's a really cool, the way that it cuts to the close up and then immediately back to the action. It just, it's really tastefully done. Something that Woo does really well and people underestimate about him is that he's willing to, visually emphasize the these kind of small, like just seemingly unimportant to a lot of filmmakers, these elements of, say, for example, an action sequence. It's where he shines. He just knows where people will connect emotionally.
Yeah, he's really, like, his action scenes are particularly chaotic. I think that's why he likes to, you know, use so many camera angles so you understand what's happening.
But, yeah, that's true. You don't get, and obviously this film was before the big wave of shaky cam shit that happened in the, I guess, mid-2000s. Very clean action.
Yeah.
Very fixed camera work, although there are a lot of cuts. It doesn't seem tedious, and also you don't get disoriented. You know exactly what's going on, which I like. I respect that about him. I really do. Now, I've heard stories, because I know with absolute certainty that that Woo had some issues with crew members. Actually, a couple people were fired.
At really?
Least one notable, I believe the cinematographer, I'm not positive on that, but was replaced. Very, you know, 3 weeks into shooting or something like that. And I've heard, and I can't corroborate this. I was quickly trying to, I feel like I've seen it in, say, for example, one of the documentaries on Alan Smithy, or the, you know, the lore of Alan Smithy, the name, that he did apply for an Alan Smithy for this film. And that he wasn't able to get it because of the fact that he was such a prominent part of the promotion.
Right.
And
he'd already signed up to do a promotional cycle, but he...
Well, he's already... He was just in the news. Very similar to what happened with Tony Kaye with American History X, where he had already been out talking about almost his dissatisfaction with the film.
Right.
And so... everyone at that point already knew he was the director of American History X, so granting him an Alan Smithy would make no sense to the Directors Guild. And the same thing very much happened with John Woo, but to the opposite, where there was just all of this press coming out. Woo's coming on to do Mission Impossible 2 and you know, get ready for elaborate fight sequences and action sequences and explosions and doves and all of these things. That
doves, he loves them. But they wouldn't
they're
give
pigeons
him
in this movie if it, you know, if it's
they didn't give him final cut.
They wouldn't give him an Alan Smithy, and yeah, they wouldn't give him final cut either. He made a 3.5-hour version of this film. And the studio's like, just no, just come back to us when it's 1 hour and 20 minutes. So, yeah, I'd love to see the three. Well, I don't know if I'd love to see the 3.5-hour version of this film, but that's probably, I read an interesting article talking about that's probably why all of the plot holes in this film exist, because it was really just cut and paste. You know, there's some unaired early episodes of Mermel, like there's a Bond one that happened before we started officially taping this show, and Devin and I argued back and forth for 4 hours with microphones on,
yeah,
about James Bond,
right?
And we'll go back and do a Bond episode for everyone listening one of these days, but I, you know, there's no way to edit that down so to make it coherent, and so I can completely see where Woo's coming from, that he'd be dissatisfied with whatever the finished product was,
because like
you're
gonna have characters referencing things that happen that the audience hasn't even seen.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, I'm reading something here on Robert Towne, the screenwriter, was brought on, and his quote is, "It was an interesting problem because by the time I got involved, there were certain action pieces around which the story had to be written. Or at very least, the story couldn't interfere with the action pieces. These scenes, through the storytelling process, had become solidified in John Woo's mind. So what it really came down to is somebody saying, these are the action sequences that we've got. How about telling the story?"
Like, that is so backwards.
Can you really blame anybody but yourself when you're like, okay, so we've got a motorcycle fight, and we've got the doves, and we've got...
We need Tom Cruise walking through a flaming door.
So, what's the movie about? I just told you what it's about.
It's like, regardless of story, the following things are going to happen.
Yeah, we need, and of course, again, another staple of the series, we already alluded to The Disavowed, the Going Rogue, all of these things. He also has to be at some point in the film hanging from a rope.
Mm-hmm.
It's mandatory.
Well, hanging from something.
Someone has to be hanging from something, exactly, or it's not Mission Impossible. Like, if you ever have a dream, or you think you're dreaming and you're not certain, and you end up disavowed, hanging from a rope, hanging out with Ving Rhames, you're in a Mission Impossible dream. That's what you're doing right now. And yeah, that's so sad.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, who can you blame but yourself?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say don't grant him the Alan Smithy on the grounds that, like, you're pretty much, like, you did this to yourself.
Yeah.
It sounds suspiciously like the guy who directed Wild Wild West, which is a huge piece of shit. He was determined to have a giant metal spider in his film, regardless.
Well, that's the producer. That's
what the movie would be.
Yeah, that's the producer. I remember that from Kevin Smith's first talk there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What is that producer's name? I can't remember.
John Peters.
That's who it is.
Wow. Sonnenfeld.
Yeah. Yeah, John Peters, he loved the big spiders. He wanted the big spiders in a movie.
But didn't this also happen with one? Didn't Brian De Palma start filming before they had a completed script?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he did. That's why, like, for example, there's a lot more than just that kissing scene I alluded to that's in that opening sequence and in the trailers that never made it to the final cut.
Yeah, he had to get rid of them because a test audience didn't like them or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of films like that. Like, we've talked about briefly The Fugitive, that film basically not having a script and them showing up every day and just kind of writing pages and being like, here, Harrison, here, Tommy Lee Jones, just act this out.
Really?
Just, like, figure it out. I don't know. That's why there is a lot of ad lib. And, like, for example, we talked about it too with that film, that whole sequence, the St. Paddy's Day parade sequence, that's just the real parade. They just happen to be there filming and they're like, all right, run through the fucking parade. And they just got a couple of steady cams and went.
That's great.
And there's a lot of stuff like that in Mission Impossible. It really, with the first two specifically, there's a lot of these, great behind the scenes stories where you just find out, oh fuck, you know, they had no idea what the hell they were doing and they just went for it, you know, which you got to respect.
That would never happen now.
Yeah, you figure who knows? You'd hope that that the film is a little bit more coherent nowadays. Obviously, as you alluded to off air, Devin, $80 million the budget of the first film, comparative to what was the newest film made for?
The most recent was $150 million.
Yeah, so substantial jump. And they didn't know what they were getting into. That's the truth of it.
Well, yeah, the two latest are both $150 million, and they both made, well, $694 and $682 respectively.
Yeah,
so
worldwide.
If you make an MI film, you're guaranteed to make $550 million. I would get a little lazy and start going back to the old ways of doing scripts, which is to say not having one.
Yeah. Okay, it's called Mission Impossible. There's here's the action pieces.
And because these movies are only ever as good as their villains, you notice that, like, things... When characters are sitting around discussing what's to be done, it's getting increasingly desperate, like, you know.
Yeah, the first one is so beautiful in that tense sequence of the four of them sitting there talking, breaking down all of the obstacles that they're going to face when they get into Langley.
Yeah.
Versus, obviously, the first go-around with Jeremy Renner in four, where they're in a fucking train with all this technology, and they're just like, I don't know, we're going to do some shit.
Yeah, or, like, I mean, they do have a detailed... plan put together with the Simon Pegg one when they're standing around the room with the double agent. You know, it's like, well, you have to hold your breath for 2 minutes, and Ethan doesn't even say anything. He's just like, well, obviously that's going to work because I'm Ethan Hunt.
What is this? This is the underwater scene in five.
Yeah,
that's 6 minutes. He has to hold his breath for 6 minutes.
Really?
And he actually did it.
I thought it was two.
Because he's an idiot.
6 minutes.
Yeah.
But, like, in the movie, he doesn't do it. She has to resuscitate him, right?
Yeah, but he actually is legitimately underwater for that long and, like, trained with champion, like, deep-sea divers and shit.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know what's wrong with this man.
He, like, must be
brain
damaged.
What does he have to prove?
He has a lot to prove. He's a short guy.
He's not that short. Like,
is he not? I thought
he was,
like,
5'8".
Oh, I thought he was, like...
He's not like 5'2 or something.
He's got a lot to prove. One day he's going to try to leave the Church of Scientology, and David Miscavige will release all of his auditing sessions in which he admits to being attracted to Val Kilmer.
Who isn't?
Can be my co-pilot anytime.
Yeah.
Man, Val Kilmer's face just gets bigger and bigger. It just keeps growing throughout the years. Like, Devin, when I was living with you in 2008, we watched a movie, a Val Kilmer movie called Deja Vu, where, like, they bend the universe in half so they can go back in time to save a girl from, I don't know, slipping on a pen or some bullshit. And Val Kilmer's face was gigantic then. And that was 8 years ago. Now.
Yeah, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, he was Mr. Potato Head.
Yeah.
Like, he was brilliant in that. But even seeing some of the press afterwards, like...
His face is
his
a potato.
Head next to Robert Downey Jr.'s head.
His face is a potato and his body is a pickle. He's a potato pickle. He's a weird, weird looking guy.
Oh, I really hope this makes it into the episode.
I would like to see Val Kilmer as a Mission Impossible villain.
Oh, that would be great.
That would be nice.
That would be great.
He played a villain recently in a really bad movie. I forgot
the
name.
He's a quality actor.
Great actor.
In any case, I think this may be a good time, just so we can get this thing back on the rails, to take a short break. Come back. Let's discuss 3 and 4, which definitely, in my opinion, rejuvenated the series. And see where it goes from there. See how we can fucking divert this conversation more so.
Cool.
Hey everyone, so next week we are going to be trying to decide which one is better, Ridley Scott's Alien or James Cameron's Aliens. I don't think we're going to accomplish much, but we're certainly going to argue a lot, so we hope you'll join us then. Additionally, I want to kind of informally announce that the week of April 18th through the 22nd, we're going to be releasing an episode every single day. In celebration of 80s action films. It will be our 80s action week from April 18th to 22nd. So join us back here then. We're going to have some fun stuff that you guys can get in on with us and yell at us, tell us how we're wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So we hope you'll join us then as well. And I'm very much looking forward to the chaos that that's going to be. It's going to be our biggest panel ever. Really looking forward to it. Okay, so we're back, and let's get into Mission Impossible 3, gentlemen. Now, we've already laid a lot of praise on Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance in this film. Another thing that I find interesting is this is J.J. Abrams' first directorial effort. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, Devin, but it is the, at the time, until recently, I believe it is the highest budget a first-time director had ever been given up until that point. Which is, you know, which makes sense. It's Mission Impossible. We need shit to blow up and so forth. And, you know, a dude hanging on a rope, these sorts of things. no Dove budget in this one, though, sadly. But this is a great film. Davian is one of my favorite villains of the entire series, right up there with what they did with the Jim Phelps character, which obviously is the only villain to, or the only character to come over from the TV show. And to kind of flip him and turn him into a villain. Very cool. But with this film, like we talked about briefly before, there's a lot of humanity, mm-hmm. and an unexpected amount of humanity in the Ethan Hunt character. And I wonder how much of that was a conscious choice, not just to forward the plot, but to give the character new depth. It really did, this film really did breathe new life into the film series. Do we all concur?
Yeah, absolutely. The scene where his girlfriend who gets shot as he's staring at her?
Fiance.
Short, the fiance, yeah. I mean, Jesus, the reaction shot there is pretty horrifying.
Yeah.
He's, I mean, what, Hoffman counts down from 10 and shoots her on 7 or something like that? You're going to tell me what I want to know. 10, no. See ya.
Yeah, and then, of course, this fucking mask reveal, like always. Oh, no.
Oh, it wasn't her, actually, but, yeah, like, it's... Yeah. I would credit J.J. Abrams, mostly. But he's such a good director.
Yeah, as we've come to find out at that point, he'd mostly been associated with writing Lost, Alias, this kind of shit, you know. But, yeah, really, really interesting film. Another cool thing that I find about this film out of the whole series... Most for me, it aesthetically is the coldest. A lot of blue, a lot of green, much more so than the other films. There's a lot of red in the color correction in the other films. I feel like a lot of all of the other films have this warmth to them, but for whatever reason, they decided to go with a much colder aesthetic.
I did notice that. Yeah, a lot of greens in this film.
Yeah,
I wonder if that. I don't know. It must have been a decision they made beforehand.
Yeah. Because you need to do that and at the lighting stage long before you'd ever get to editing, obviously. But yeah, it's interesting that it is so aesthetically different. And we talk about, I know that there's a lot of sequels that come a long way after the original, but there's not a lot of part threes, for example. Not prequels, not anything, but continuations that come 6 years after the sequel. So, you know, you got Mission Impossible in 1996. 4 years later in 2000, you have MI2. And it's not until 2006 that we get MI3.
Right.
And it's so interesting because, obviously, out of that, it's really changed the pace of how quickly these films come out. It's every couple of years kind of thing now.
Yeah, it is.
Which is interesting. And also, obviously, now you get the... like, J.J. Abrams has been an executive producer on every subsequent film.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. You see the Bad Robot emblem pre-credit roll, you know, on every film now and post-credit roll.
Right, so he's keeping an eye on things. Like, I wonder how much of this had to do with Tom Cruise at the kind of nadir of his career.
Yeah, there's some great there's some great interviews with Abrams on that very thing. Like, how he just... It was almost like Tom courted him to be his friend.
Yeah, I've read that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's so interesting.
Came just, after him for the to direct it.
Yeah.
He headhunted him.
But yeah. not even telling him that he was doing this, just kind of, hey, you're cool, let's hang out. Let's go to dinner. What do you think of this? You know, and then next thing you know, they're making a movie together, and then subsequently they're friends out of it, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's weird because like you said, well, yeah, we have it coming after 6 years after the sequel, yeah. Almost always when there's that much time, the number three is absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and it's usually like direct to video and...
Well, like Home Alone 3 with that little shit
RoboCop
who's not Macaulay
3.
Culkin. Terminator 3, which is one of the worst
ones.
Well,
that had a theatrical release, but that was, as Devin said, it redeemed itself in the last 5 minutes and then, not really. But yeah, there's not a good track record for part threes that come this far after the last iteration. And it's so interesting that it is one of the best. I think everyone has it. You have it at number one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I have it at two. Devin has it at two. It's so interesting that it really did breathe new life.
Yeah, it just shows you, like, with a steady enough hand, and, like, they're obviously making a bid for the franchise here. It was either going to stop being made forever or it was going to continue on. And now they're going to make one of these every couple of years until Tom is too old to look good.
Oh, that's not going to happen. He's going to be, like, 85 during Mission Impossible 85.
He's already starting to look a little rough, but I mean, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink. So.
It's good. You know, it's funny, too, because before he was cast, there was a whole bunch of other actors that they had, or that they were looking at.
Like who?
For some reason, Mel Gibson comes to mind,
but
he was an afterthought.
Yeah.
I can't remember who else. Really interesting. You could probably find that if you look it up on the first one, Devin.
My God, it was tough times in the late 90s, dear listeners. It's like you just could not escape Mel Gibson or Gene Hackman in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Every time you turned around, they were in a new film.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Hackman. I'm so glad he retired.
Yeah. Another interesting thing I read on 3 was that, you know, like Kerry Russell... In the beginning, her whole sequence with my head's going to explode and all that shit.
Yeah.
Or she doesn't know that. But her head does explode. Scarlett Johansson was originally cast.
Really?
For that role.
Wow.
And I don't know why she had to step out on it, but it's interesting because I really like Kerry Russell. I think that her and Ethan, like the two characters... have a really interesting bond, and it never plays as sexual, never as an attraction, just two good friends, and one of the, maybe with the exception of Luther,
mm-hmm.
The only other relationship that I can think of in the film series that seems like a true friendship. Obviously his relationship to Jim seems almost like a surrogate paternal situation in the first one, and so beyond Luther, I think that this is the most emotionally connected that you see him in a platonic kind of way with any character, which is so interesting.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, I like it. I really enjoy all of the amount that you get to root for Ethan in this film. I also love how long you get to watch Tom Cruise fucking run in this film.
Mm.
He runs for like 2 minutes on screen. Like it's literally one tracking shot of him just fucking running along, with him on the phone with Benji, just, where am I going? Just keep fucking running. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'll get there. And then of course I love the line we talked about this off air, the, you know, I'm going to die. You're going to have to kill me. And then you're going to have to bring me back. What?
Oh, that's Zap. Right. Yeah, yeah. When he zaps his head, MacGyvers it.
Yeah. So good. And I love he puts the spoon, the wooden spoon in his mouth, and it snaps when he shocks himself.
Yeah.
So good.
Gives himself amateur electroshock.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why he's so bland in the following films. He doesn't have a personality anymore.
Oh, man. And then he wakes up. And he immediately reaches for the gun, and it's like looking around,
mm-hmm.
and that's a great moment too. And then he has this shocked look when he realizes, of course, that she's killed everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "Yeah, that's right. I'm marrying this girl."
Yeah.
Yeah, great film. Any final points on this film, gentlemen?
Not really. I mean, Fishburne was all right. That's about all I can remember. I seem to recall him in the very last scene, like, well, you did it again, Hunt.
Yeah. I'm so sorry for all of the shit I put you through and that whole exchange where you had to sneak out through the vents while rocking out to classic rock.
I should have paid more attention.
Yeah. This other guy that kept putting your name on all of your files, it just seems so strange. Like, why the fuck is Dr. Manhattan so evil in this film? It's like Dr. Manhattan and Truman Capote team up to fuck up Ethan Hunt's life.
All right.
So are we moving on to four?
Ghost Protocol.
Yeah. I like this movie. I like this movie a lot. Up until this point, I wasn't a huge Jeremy Renner fan. And I think this film was one of the ones that started to change my feelings towards him. It's interesting because when you first see him, he's obviously very opposed to Ethan.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't understand why. And then, of course, that story comes out that he was tasked with the duty of protecting Ethan and his now wife, who was then subsequently killed. And he's carrying this guilt around with him because he failed them.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting. I'm sorry, can I spoil this for you, Devin? Because you haven't seen it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's so gratifying at the end of the film when you see her, you know, living out this new life, and he kind of brings Renner in. And you can literally see great, great moment in the film in terms of just very minimalist acting where you see this wave of relief come over him. It's like this great weight of guilt that's been sitting on his shoulders for years. It's put him behind a desk and driven him to fear field work has been lifted. And then he takes the fallen and goes off. And of course, you now have a new member of the soon-to-be disavowed again team.
The soon-to-be-disavowed via Ghost Protocol IMF. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a nice piece of acting, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a whole lot of that emotional vulnerability in this series, so it's good to see it when you can get it.
Yeah, and that's something I like. I don't like... Do you remember the trailers for this, where they kind of played it off as though it was going to be a big surprise? And, who are you really? And all of this shit.
No, I don't remember that.
And it bothered me because when I saw the film and realized that they were totally just baiting me into what I thought was going to be this deeper story, and it's just, oh yeah, I saw your wife get killed.
Mm.
What? And that ruined my life. Yeah. You seem to be fine.
No, I don't recall the trailer. Yeah. I don't know why. I watched a lot of movies that year, 2001.
Now, one thing that they never cleared up about that is, okay, so this Serbian death squad comes after Ethan and his wife, right?
Yeah.
And kills her, but doesn't really.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably Ethan was in that Russian prison because he killed all of them.
Right.
So now he just killed a bunch of innocent death squad guys. Well, not innocent, but they didn't.
I don't know if innocent death squad
just
is
a bunch of innocent members of a death squad.
Well, he just killed them needlessly, is my point.
He had no reason to kill them.
Yeah, purposelessly.
There were a lot of reasons to kill them, I'm sure. Like, he's not doing it for himself. He's doing it for somebody else.
Doing it for all those families that have been torn apart by the results of their death squatting.
Yeah, I mean, they were bad guys anyway, so.
Oh, yeah, so who cares? They're disposable.
It's like that Simpsons where the giant advertisements come to life, and Chief Wiggum accidentally shoots the high school football basketball captain because he's super tall. Chief, you just shot the basketball captain. Yeah, he was turning into a monster, though.
So, the other thing that somewhat throws me off about this film is that weird sequence at the beginning with Hanaway, this supposedly like great spy, right? And he's getting away, and he's being tracked, by the rest of his team, and he dies, and that seems to be a conduit for Paula Patton's character to seek revenge, you know, and there's supposed to be a lot of humanity in that side story, and I just feel as though it falls flat. Like, there's nothing ever really there for me. You know, you get the confrontation, like with is it Moreau? Sabine Moreau? Sabine something.
Sabine.
Yeah, Moreau.
Moreau? Okay. Yeah. So you get this confrontation, and there, you know, the action sequence, and it's all very choreographed, and it feels to me like, even though she has to not kill her and rein in her emotions and all these things, it all seems very sterile to me. It, you know, the same kind of problems that I had with Phantom Menace, with the Obi-Wan Darth Maul fight sequence at the end that a lot of people love, and I personally feel as though there was an opportunity there to show a side of Obi-Wan that you'd never seen, and they didn't do it. Much in this way, as much as they're trying to show that she is an agent first and a human second, I don't ever feel that conflicted about it. Like, I would have almost been happier. I feel like I would have gotten a little bit more out of it if she just killed her.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no reason to keep that character around anyway. And obviously she eventually does kill her, but it just seems so pointless at that point.
Right.
Yeah, like it just... And obviously, it's preceded by the whole sequence, the climbing on the tower in Dubai, which is amazing.
Mm.
And again, another great example of the escalation in these films in terms of the action set pieces, just continuously raising the bar. And I love that Brad Bird actually like shot all of that. You know, there's no, even with the, say, for example, the jump in the third one onto the roof, a lot of that is done in the studio, and then it's kind of, it's, you know, in front of a green screen, so they build a little bit of the set and then do the rest in front of a green screen. With that, it's literally all, like, cameras shooting through the windows.
Wow.
Which
yeah.
is so cool.
Yeah.
And they obviously had to legitimately get permission for that. And I believe they started Tom at the top with the helicopter. They took him up there, and then he climbed down. Which is cool.
Jesus.
Yeah. Again, you're crazy, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because they keep raising the bar for these action sequences, but they never raise the stakes. It's always just some guy cackling who wants to take over the world or just get himself some money. As
yeah.
Five.
And that one seemed kind of, and also, it's a great point. All that they're trying to accomplish is just accessing a room. It's very much like what they were trying to do in number two when he had to, you know, jump from the top and lower himself down through a tall building. It's the exact same thing. There's no more emotional investment in it.
I believe they have to access a room in five, too. They get a new face for Cal, Simon Pegg. Sorry, not Simon Cal.
Well, but that...
Simon Cal gets a new face.
Yeah, but Renner is the one in five that he has the... Because he has the magnet suit, like where he, you know, it's like you jump and I catch you. That whole thing. It's like you jump and you catch me, and
yeah.
I catch you.
Right.
And he's freaking out about this. Which, again, it's like Renner is the best part of that film in a lot of scenes.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. And especially, like, it shows how much quality he's bringing to that role when I can honestly tell you I'm still not a huge fan of his. But I know he's better than everyone else in these films.
Right, right.
Yeah. So in four... in four he's the guy who I jump and I catch you, and then I can't remember what's the scene in five that they have to
infiltrate some kind of the syndicate headquarters, and Simon Pegg does that. It's some kind of biosecurity. He either has to get a new thumbprint or he has to get a new face.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And they're doing it on the quick as he's going through.
Right. They have a 10-second window or something, yeah. And Simon Pegg's shitting his pants, but he gets through somehow.
Yeah. No, it's... And that's the whole Tom holding his breath for 6 minutes thing. And
yes,
so forth.
It is.
Yeah.
So, like, the franchise is usually... comes down to them getting into rooms they don't have access to.
We'll add that to the list of prerequisites for a Mission Impossible film.
You can simplify anything.
Yeah, disavowed, hanging from a roof, getting into a room,
accessing rooms thought to be inaccessible.
Yeah.
Going rogue.
Yeah. elaborate jumps, these kinds of things. They're staples of the franchise. Ving Rhames.
Ving Rhames, you know. I mean, like, one of my favorite quotes about playing in a band is that it's playing music is mostly about carrying black boxes from one end of town to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Transporting, sorry, you know, amplifiers, whatever. So, yeah, the whole MI series can be melted down into that. Ving Rhames.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into rooms.
Yeah, it's
double,
but they're
agents.
Still, they're so fun. I don't understand it because they're greater, somehow they're greater films than the sum of their parts, which I find very interesting. Because have you ever had to try and explain any of these films? Like, try and explain, particularly, say, for example, Ghost Protocol,
mm-hmm.
to someone. And just be like, okay, so they have to go into Ghost Protocol. They initiate Ghost Protocol, and they're on a train, and they're talking about things that they have to do. And then they have a printer and a briefcase, and Tom Cruise climbs on the tallest building in the world.
Like, yeah, or five. It's like, see, the Prime Minister says not to let anyone in the room, but the Prime Minister is actually Tom Cruise wearing the Prime Minister's face. Know what I mean?
No.
Yeah, it's fuck. It's so weird, but they somehow are just great films.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on 4, I guess, gentlemen?
No.
Actually, you know what? I have a few more. We talked about the film's quality is dependent on the quality of the villains, and Michael Nyquist is a great villain.
Yep.
I alluded to a little bit before the that Bogdan character, and I love him being kind of this intermediary between Ethan and the arms dealer.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great moment. And I'm just amazed that a director in Brad Bird, who had never done anything live action. Now, that being said, obviously The Incredibles is exactly that. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Two's coming. And Iron Giant, super underrated animated film. A lot of great stuff, but he'd never done anything live action. And to get this ambitious, amazing, amazing first time around. It's pretty amazing. All right, so let's take a little break, come back, we'll talk about 5 and our hopes for the future of the series, and wrap it up with final thoughts.
Cool. It was a bizarre scene because, I mean, the agent's justification for going into the room and talking to Ethan is to, you know, kind of express his disappointment,
mm-hmm.
Ethan, and he just goes in and says something like that, like, I'm very disappointed in you. And then he just stands there and yeah, like, like they're just watching in a two-way mirror as he's standing there. I'm very disappointed in you. And then he just stares at him for 10 seconds. How did they not know what was up?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, you have to suspend. But, you know, another thing that disappoints me about Ethan Hunt is he never has enough kind of quips. He's not Bond, where he has a dry wit, and he's not Bruce Willis, where he's self-deprecating, really.
Yeah.
It's always, like, the most obvious thing. Like, in the newest one, you know, the car goes flying, and he's like, you done your seatbelt? You know, it's like... it's, like, written... It's, like, the most obvious thing. He's always reaching for the most obvious punchline.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought he was fairly... As much as his character itself didn't have a lot of development in the first one, I thought that... Because David Kep he's a writer on the first film and the second film, if I'm not mistaken. I feel exactly the same way as you do, but I felt as though there was a little bit more interesting dialogue for the Ethan character in 1 and 2, particularly in 1, like the whole cappuccino machine exchange, and just a few, you know, red light, green light, all of these things, which I realize is kind of, he's just repeating what Emilio Estevez said earlier, but still.
Right.
There's some fun points, but I see what you're saying. It's not, it's a very cold delivery. He needs like a Simon Pegg, which I guess is why it works so well.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he needs to be the straight man. even when he's all doped up in the newest one and he falls over the car,
mm-hmm.
I really am just laughing at the fact that they had to shoot that and like, okay, Tom, so you're going to fall over the car now. I'm not laughing so much at his physical comedy. It's the fact that someone wrote this in the script.
Yeah,
Ethan falls over car and Tom's like, okay, I want to do my own stunts. All right, so we're back, and let's get into five a little bit here. Right off the jump, I just want to say this is my favorite cast of any of the films. With the, you know, even though Philip Seymour Hoffman is my favorite of the villains, John Voight a close second, I love this cast. I think it's a really unique one. I think that it's my favorite, obviously, female character in the series, even more so than Claire in Rebecca Ferguson, Ilsa Faust. Is that it? Something like that. Ilsa Faust. Obviously, Simon Pegg's back for his third go around in these films. Ving Rhames. Tom Holland is the Prime Minister that you were alluding to in the last segment. Sean Harris, which we also alluded to a couple times, who is also Ian Curtis in 24-Hour Party People. Fantastic.
And Alec Baldwin.
Yeah,
in this
of course,
one.
Baldwin.
As, is he in the IMF or is he?
No, he's the CIA guy.
CIA. Right,
yeah,
right,
that's
yes.
trying to bring him down.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you know, finds that he wants to run the IMF.
Yeah. He
after being knocked out.
Has a complete 180 there.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you knew this, but Tom Cruise is actually in this film. Which is pretty, that's a pretty big get for them. And Jeremy Renner also making his return. Really interesting. This is Christopher McQuarrie's first go-around. And the reason I say first go-around is because obviously he's been announced as the director for number six, which is interesting because he's the only director in the film series to get a second chance at the plate, so to speak. So it's kind of interesting. This one obviously, again, raises the stakes on the action pieces with the great plane stunt at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
which is really ridiculous. And why you would put yourself through that, I have no idea.
He does have a quip, Tom Cruise, when he's flying.
Yeah, because he's telling Benji to open the door, right?
Yeah, and he opens the wrong one. Yeah, that's great.
And then another great sequence that I really like in the film is the opera sequence when when he's there and Ferguson's trying to, or you think she's trying to kill the there, she's got the rifle and she's got it set really strangely on her leg, by the way. I thought that was a little over sexualized for my liking. I think that it's one of the few parts in the film where they got a little too focused on getting a nice sexy shot of her legs and posterior in there.
Right, they really
not that I'm complaining
to her femininity there, yeah,
but that's from the perspective of a male. I feel as though it takes away from it a little bit. Obviously, her coming out of the pool is a little bit of a Bo Derek moment or something like that. But in any case, she's a wicked character, Ilsa, so I'm going to let it slide. I love the other big action piece, which is that piece that you alluded to earlier, Danny, with Benji breaking into the... you know, to this high security facility, and then Tom Cruise, he plays himself in the film, having to hold his breath for 6 minutes after he jumps into this huge, weird, spinny turbine thing where there's apparently some kind of computer access.
Yeah, there's a hard drive in the turbine thing. It's like a donut shaped water tank that spins really fast, and the hard drive is there.
Yeah.
And so he has to go in there and get it.
Which is ridiculous.
It's really, really stupid.
But it does allow for that great sequence that comes after, which is disoriented Tom Cruise, disoriented Ethan, and that wonderful car chase, which I love the behind-the-scenes footage of that, where where you find out that Tom Cruise was putting Simon Pegg's heated seat on the whole time they were shooting that, and they were shooting that for like 3 days. And so Simon Pegg started doing it back to him and like put black electrical tape over the heated seat thing, and he kept looking like, oh, this might, no, okay. I like that. I like hearing those stories because, as we alluded to, it bothers me, regardless of what we think of him on a personal level, it bothers me that Tom Cruise is somewhat almost demonized in media to a certain extent. It's troublesome for me. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, he's thought of as a humorless kind of just a unpleasant guy to be around.
Yeah, so. And those aren't the stories that we ever hear now. You know that.
Yeah, he's playing practical jokes on his cast members and actually being a person.
Mm-hmm.
Devin, can I have a piece of this explosive gum?
Unfortunately, it's out.
Oh, jeez.
That's...
Devin took the last piece of exploding gum.
Red light, green light.
You love Gene Reno with it.
Ah, of course. That's why I haven't seen Gene Reno in anything lately. Mm-hmm. Devin got to him. You bastard.
You have been impossibled. That's what he says, right? That's the catchphrase.
You've been impossible.
Oh, yeah. Rebecca's name is Ilsa Faust in this.
Now, we already alluded a little bit to that second or the third act of the film that just kind of drags. And I hate to keep bagging on this, but it's just such a fucking 180 from that opening sequence where you get... Ethan going into the record store and getting his message, and then of course it's a trap, and you know, the smoke filled room and all of these things, and then you get this ending where it's just like, I captured a bad guy in a box, and somehow he didn't see the box when he walked into it, and I don't understand what happened. It's like you were going along so smoothly here, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you had probably the most accessible of any of the films in terms of, you know, a film that you can, no matter what kind of movies you like, you can cling on to something. Mm-hmm. And then that whole exchange happened where it's like, oh, no, you can't kill me because I'm the only record of this information and I've memorized it.
Yeah.
And it's just terrible.
But then the way it ends, like, you got Hunley, the CIA agent, he witnesses the IMF, the successful operation, the whole fake British prime minister thing, and then so he goes and defends them, and they get legitimized again.
Mm-hmm.
The IMF gets restored, and he gets to run it. So, I mean, they've been sort of the whole
Ghost
Protocol.
Until the next movie when he's disavowed again.
Yeah. Welcome back, Hunt. Hunt, you're out.
Welcome back, Hunt. Someone is releasing files to a counterintelligence organization that it's got your ID on the file transfer. So you're disavowed.
You're under arrest again.
Yeah, you're under arrest again. You're gonna have to break out through a vent again. And yet somehow, like, we jokingly say all this, but those movies are so fun.
Yeah.
Every time around, I have no problem with it. You know, after the fact, I think back and go, that was the same plot to get him to his end goal, or get him into the plot, rather. It's the same plot device used to get him into the actual meat of the story. And it never seems to really bother me in the viewing, though.
Right. It's always,
I just want to see shit explode.
It's always after the fact when you intellectualize it.
Mm-hmm.
When it's of just your visceral reaction, it's like, holy, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Holy shit balls.
Okay, so I'd like to do a fun experiment before we wrap it up. For our closing, I would like to have you guys, we'll all take a turn, and on the spot, I didn't tell you about this because I just thought of it.
Okay.
I'd like you to, because Mission Impossible 6 is coming, I would like you to pitch me a film, pitch me number 6 in this film franchise. Obviously, you know, what we do know about the film is that Tom Cruise is in it.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably it will end up making somewhere around $600 million at the box office.
Yep.
and obviously we know that Chris McQuarrie is directing again.
Mm-hmm.
So with those factors in mind, pitch me your plot synopsis for MI6.
Give me 30 seconds. Talk about something and I'll put this together. I'm putting my plot together, guys.
Okay. Devin, you want to go first or do you want to wait on?
No, yeah, I'll go. Okay. I mean, here's one thing that I'd like to see done. Because I think in a lot of cases you see the movie from one narrative point of view.
Yep.
And things are revealed to that point of view.
Yeah.
And so that's how they establish, you know, that you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
But I would like to see a movie that goes through so every person thinks they're doing the right thing.
Oh, a little bit of almost the Silence of the Lambs, like following the killer too, kind of thing.
Yeah. Well yeah, I'm yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, you've got, like, you know, Simon Pegg is doing computer things.
Yeah.
Jeremy Renner is doing Jeremy Renner things. you know, Ving Rhames is also doing computer things. I guess they're going to have to fight for that one.
Yeah, they're going to have to share their computer terminal.
And each of them thinks that they're helping Ethan, but certain things that they're doing are endangering him.
Interesting.
Like, they, you know, everybody's been given bad information and they're all operating on, you know, and so it goes through each of their stories as though they are the hero in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
When at certain points they're really fucking the other person over without their own personal knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you would accomplish it without doing separate tracks, like without, here's one person's point of view, here's another person's. I think if you interspliced it, it might be less surprising,
yeah.
Maybe. But
well, but then again, maybe for example, the perspective that it, much like we talk about with because it is a good tool, and it is something. For example, in terms of spy films, you see a lot in the Bond films because you see what the villain does and you see what Bond does, and you know everything that's and how it's going to play out. It's the tension of knowing that Bond doesn't know that is the driving force of the film, which is so compelling. So I think I like that. I like that. Do you have any ideas on the story?
No, I don't. I mean, I like nuclear bombs, and I think it's a shame. Like, I don't know. It always seems really lackluster when it's like, in this most recent one, like, they're after $2.4 billion. I don't know. That's, like, a reasonable amount of money.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, like, it's a lot of money, yeah. But like, you know, it's, like, a less than a tenth of what Apple has on hand.
Yeah, if they just didn't make this movie, they could pay for it.
Yeah. Like, they're it just, it seems really underwhelming, you know? And even,
although, like, I do love that Indian billionaire so good in the, when they're trying to hack into his satellite dish and he's trying to.
Number four, right?
Is
that
it?
One, so.
No, that, oh yeah, shit. That isn't four.
But yeah, I mean, I like nuclear bombs. I think that's a good, you know, a good thing to go on, because it's like, you know, it's so you can really just have them at your mercy, you know, like, what do you want? Like $100 billion. That's crazy. Well, otherwise everything's going to blow up. Whereas if it's like, I want $2.4 billion, like, you don't really have to twist their arm that much. Like, they spend, they have probably lost like 100 times that just in the books, you know. They're like, the U.S. government is just like throwing this money all over the place in terms of defense spending and stuff like that. That, like, 2.4 billion is probably a rounding error.
Yeah,
it's like, really, that's all you.
That's all you
that's
want.
All you want. Yeah. Like, that's.
All right, I got my film.
All right, let's do it.
Okay, Mission Impossible 6. Okay, the film opens with Benji and Ethan Hunt sitting in a bar. They're hanging out, and they're watching China land on the moon.
Mm.
Okay? So then, you know, they watch the moon landing, and they're like, that's cool, that's great. And it flashes to 6 years later.
Hunt gets some intel that a Chinese military general with access to biological rockets that are on the moon, he goes rogue and disappears into the rural Chinese countryside.
Of course.
Right? So Benji, posing as a tourist, infiltrates the Chinese general's rural stronghold by pretending to be the Chinese general's girlfriend. He's got one of those fake rubber faces that they're always using. Meanwhile, Hunt is framed for the murder of Hunley, that's Alec Baldwin's character, and he's put in jail. But Benji can't help him because he can't break cover because he's pretending to be a Chinese woman.
Okay.
So at this point, Hunt breaks out of prison with the assistance of a fellow prisoner, played by Chris Cooper. They fly to China.
Of course it's Chris Cooper. You would put Chris Cooper in any movie.
I know. This is Chris Cooper from The Town. He's doing life imprisonment for robbing banks.
Okay.
So they fly to China to meet up with Benji, and they steal a couple motorcycles, and as they're going out to the Chinese general stronghold, it turns out Chris Cooper is a double agent. He's a mole. The Chinese general had anticipated that Hunt would come after him, so he put one of his henchmen in an American prison. He did this somehow. I don't know how. Anyways, there's a hand-to-hand combat, extended fight sequence, which Hunt wins, and then he throws Chris Cooper's dead body off a bridge. But it lands on a boat, and the boat explodes. So Benji, he gets found out. His cover gets broken because the general asks him something that only his girlfriend would know, and Benji doesn't know how to answer it. So he gets captured, and he's being held at gunpoint. But Hunt gets there just in time. And, whatever. He gets Benji out of there somehow, and then there's a extended motorcycle chase scene. While they're on the motorcycles, as the Chinese general is coming after them, Benji hacks into the general's cell phone and shoots the rockets safely into space. That's where they
blow up the sun?
I guess they don't blow up at all because I don't know. That'd be kind of anticlimactic, though. They're just flying into space and they just sort of fade out as...
Yeah.
But that's all I can think of, really.
Excellent.
If they all hit each other.
On the way to space?
Yeah, they all hit each other and land on a faraway planet and create some kind of...
New life form.
And that serves as a prelude to the next movie where Ethan Hunt has to fight aliens.
Yeah, Mission Impossible 7, Alien Protocol.
Yeah.
All right, what do you guys got for fake films?
All right. So I'm just going to wing this, fuck it. Okay, so this film, now that the events of 5 have played out, I want to go back and borrow from the arc in 4, which is, of course, America accidentally on purpose blowing up the Kremlin. Or, America doesn't. Technically, it's Mikhail Nyquist's character, but they still aren't comfortable with that answer. They still have to show a strength to their people and show that they do not accept these sorts of unwarranted attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So they want the American government to turn over Ethan Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously with the whole CIA storyline of number 5, they know their names have come into the public eye. And Ethan being a trainer and so forth, technically not being active anymore again, he has to go rogue.
Yeah. Of course.
To clear his name and find a way to satisfy the Russians' need to kill somebody. Okay? So, he enlists...
So Ethan has to, one, go rogue. Of course.
So. Obviously, Alec Baldwin's character turns him over to the authorities to transport him to
Russia.
On a FedEx plane because product placement. But before they get on the plane, Alec Baldwin tells Jeremy Renner to slip him a device which Benji has programmed, which neutralizes the guards. So even though he is in handcuffs, he jumps without a parachute out of the plane and lands safely on his feet. Entire stunt done by Tom Cruise. Okay.
He lands on his feet. Where is he now exactly?
He's in the Crimean Peninsula. Okay. So it's a war-torn area, and there's the war going on as it is now between the Ukraine and Russia, and Russia has taken over the country. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's power outages and all these things. So he enlists the aid of a lovely young lady, mm-hmm. of course. Who has a unique set of skills, as one would in a Mission Impossible film,
yeah,
to help him get into Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So they make their way to Russia, where he has to find a fake film version of Putin and convince him of the events that led up to the climax of 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at the same time, the Impossible Mission Force tells Renner that he, along with Ving Rhames and Benji, and also they enlist Ilsa Faust, who for some reason has now joined their ranks, mm-hmm. Has to go after Ethan, mm-hmm. and are responsible to bring him to Russia. So, and much like you said, Devin, so now they're trying to help Ethan, but also are trying to save their jobs, as they always are.
Hmm.
At this point, in order to get to where fake Putin is, he must rappel down a very tall building,
mm-hmm.
via a rope.
Yep. Yeah.
With the assistance of his lovely Russian counterpart. And the film's big climax, of course, is in the form of a giant a Russian bodyguard who you find out is the son of Nyquist's character from Number 4. And he is not having this. So, and he's played by Kevin Nash.
Okay.
So Kevin Nash and Tom Cruise fight it out, and he chokes him to death a la Mel Gibson on Gary Busey in Lethal Weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Triangle choke on the grass, sprinkler going.
Gotcha.
So he gets to Putin, explains his shit, everything's good, and he's able to come home until he is disavowed. In Number 7.
The next he's allowed to come home until he is disavowed the following morning.
And that's how the movie ends, with him being disavowed yet again. Cue the music. Also, I'm going to bring Hans Zimmer back to do the score, because he obviously scored Number 2, which everyone always forgets. And it's going to be the first Hans Zimmer team up with Danny Elfman. It's going to be so the scores of 1 and 2 meeting together to create just the most irrational smorgasbord of bullshit music ever. Gotcha. It's just going to be 1 and 2's music running simultaneously. That's what I'm going to do. All right. Any final thoughts on any of these films, gentlemen?
More Tom Cruise going rogue.
Yeah. I feel like there's not enough rogue in this film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Disavowing.
It does make you think about a lot of, I know they're fairly innocuous these days, or at least it seems from the outside, but just like the heyday of the CIA Special Activities Division, running drugs in during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And staging coups in South American countries, how much oversight there really ever was over this kind of stuff, and whether the president would sometimes get a call and be like, that guy does not fucking work for us anymore. Yeah. Like, yeah. Strike him from the record.
Yeah.
We had nothing to do with that.
Like, he's a star on a wall now.
Like, if you could really go through all of the years of it, like obviously not completely in subject matter, but just in you know, all of the disavowing and stuff like that. How, mm-hmm. how much of that really does go on in the,
yeah.
the intelligence world?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wrap it up?
Yep.
All right. So remember, this is just the beginning of the conversation. We want to continue it on with you. And the best way to reach out to us is always on Twitter. So I'm at NotBrandonFleet on Twitter. You guys want to offer up your Twitters?
I'm at LeafsLoveHurts.
At YR underscore homeboy.
Right on. And you can also reach out to us on our show Twitter handle, if you will, at Mermel Podcast, at MRML Podcast. We have some really interesting stuff coming up, so remember to subscribe to us over on YouTube. If that's where you're watching us, remember to check us out on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, TuneIn Radio, whatever your podcatcher of choice may be. We're probably there, and if we're not, let us know, and we'll rectify that for you. And yeah, I think that's about it. I had fun, guys. I was a little bit worried about this episode, I'm not going to lie, as much as I love these films.
Yeah, me too.
It's always weird to talk about them because, like I said, they don't make any sense out of the context of the film universe that they reside in. But they are a real interesting and roller coaster-esque series. So thanks for a great talk. Thanks to everyone for listening. I don't know. Thanks for hanging out with us.
You think Simon Pegg knows what happened to Emilio Estevez? Do you think they ever told him? Or do they just keep that one a secret?
Yeah.
Oh, we used to have a computer guy.
Yeah.
Ethan, I'm in position on top of the elevator. No, get off the go to a tunnel somewhere.
Where's John Voight? Yeah.